commentaries on the four last books of Moses, arranged in the form of a harmony. Volume 4 by John Calvin. Numbers 11, 16 to 32. And the Lord said unto Moses, Gather unto me 70 men of the elders of Israel, whom thou knowest to be the elders of the people and officers over them, and bring them unto the tabernacle of the congregation, that they may stand there with thee. And I will come down and talk with thee there, and I will take of the Spirit which is upon thee, and will put it upon them, and they shall bear the burden of the people with thee, that thou bear it not thyself alone. And say thou unto the people, Sanctify yourselves against tomorrow, and ye shall eat flesh. For ye have wept in the ears of the Lord, saying, Who shall give us flesh to eat? For it was well with us in Egypt. Therefore the Lord will give you flesh, and ye shall eat. Ye shall not eat one day, nor 2 days, nor 5 days, neither 10 days, nor 20 days, but even a whole month, until it come out at your nostrils, and it be loathsome unto you, because that ye have despised the Lord which is among you, and have wept before him, saying, Why came we forth out of Egypt? And Moses said, The people among whom I am are 600,000 footmen, and thou hast said, I will give them flesh, that they may eat a whole month. Shall the flocks and the herds be slain for them to suffice them? Or shall all the fish of the sea be gathered together for them to suffice them? And the Lord said unto Moses, Is the Lord's hand waxed short? Thou shalt see now whether my word shall come to pass unto thee or not. And Moses went out and told the people the words of the Lord, and gathered the 70 men of the elders of the people, and set them round about the tabernacle. And the Lord came down in a cloud, and spoke unto him, and took of the Spirit that was upon him, and gave it unto the 70 elders. And it came to pass that when the Spirit rested upon them, they prophesied, and did not cease. But there remained 2 of the men in the camp. The name of the one was Eldad, and the name of the other Medad. And the Spirit rested upon them. And they were of them that were written, but went not out unto the tabernacle. And they prophesied in the camp. And there ran a young man, and told Moses, and said, Eldad and Medad do prophesy in the camp. And Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of Moses, one of his young men, answered and said, My lord Moses, forbid them. And Moses said unto him, Enviest thou for my sake? Would God that all the Lord's people were prophets, and that the Lord would put his Spirit upon them. And Moses gat him into the camp, he and the elders of Israel. And there went forth a wind from the Lord, and brought quails from the sea, and let them fall by the camp, as it were a day's journey on this side, and as it were a day's journey on the other side, round about the camp, and as it were 2 cubits high upon the face of the earth. And the people stood up all that day, and all that night, and all the next day, and they gathered the quails. He that gathered least gathered 10 homers, and they spread them all abroad for themselves round about the camp. And while the flesh was yet between their teeth, ere it was chewed, the wrath of the Lord was kindled against the people, and the Lord smote the people with a very great plague. And he called the name of that place Kibroth Hataava, because there they buried the people that lusted. And the people journeyed from Kibroth Hataava unto Hazeroth, and abode at Hazeroth. Verse 16. And the Lord said unto Moses, Gather unto me 70 men. God complies with the request of Moses by associating with him 70 companions, by whose care and assistance he may be relieved from some part of his labor. yet not without some signs of indignation. For, by taking from him some portion of his spirit to distribute amongst the others, he inflicts upon him that mark of disgrace which he deserved. I know that some regard it differently, and think that nothing was taken away from Moses, but that the others were endued with new grace, such as Moses had been preeminent for possessing alone before. But since the words expressly declare that God will make them partakers of that grace which he will take from Moses himself, I by no means admit the truth of this subtle exposition. The passage in Genesis 26:37 is quoted, in which it is said, "Hast thou not reserved a blessing for me?" But when God expressly says, "I will separate of the Spirit which is upon thee," there can be no question but that a diminution is indicated. For as long as Moses alone was appointed to rule the people, he was so supplied with the necessary gifts of the Spirit, as that his ability should not be inferior to the greatness of the labor. God now promises that the others shall be his companions in such sort as that he divides his gifts among them all. I have no doubt, then, but that this division comprehends punishment in it, and from hence we may gather a useful piece of instruction, that is, that the greater the difficulty is which God imposes upon anyone, the greater is the liberality with which he treats him, in order that he may be sufficient for his charge. Thus, it is in his power to work with equal efficiency by one man, as by 100 or 1,000, for he has no need of a multitude of agents, but, as he pleases, he executes his work sometimes without the aid of men, sometimes by their hands. In sum, God indirectly reproves the gross ingratitude of Moses, whereby he depreciated that marvelous grace which had hitherto shone forth in him, and he declares that he shall not be hereafter so great as he was in regard to the excellency he derived from the Spirit, inasmuch as he had in a manner thrown away the gifts of the Spirit by refusing to bear the trouble imposed upon him. Our modesty, indeed, is praiseworthy, if through consciousness of our own weakness we recoil from arduous charges. But it is too absurd for us to withdraw ourselves under this pretext from our duty, and, despising the calling of God, shake off the yoke. The word Spirit is here, as frequently elsewhere, applied to the gifts themselves, as if he had said, "I had deposited with thee gifts sufficing for the government of the people. But now, since thou refusest, I will distribute his due measure to each of the 70, so that the grace of the Spirit, which dwelt in thee alone, shall be manifestly dispersed among many." It is now asked how Moses separated the 70, whether according to his own judgment only, or by the election of the people. It is generally agreed that 6 were chosen from each tribe, and thus that they were 72, but that for the sake of brevity 2 were omitted, as amongst the Romans, they spoke of the centumviri, although they were 105, for they appointed 3 for each of the 35 tribes. Since the opinion is probable, I leave it undecided, but at the same time I retain the conjecture which I have elsewhere made, that is, that since the race of Abraham had been increased in an incredible manner in 220 years, lest so astonishing a miracle should ever be forgotten, the 70 were elected in accordance with the number of the fathers who had gone down into Egypt with Jacob. And in fact this seems to have been with them, as it were, a sacred number, as recalling to their memory that little band from which they had derived their origin. For before the law was promulgated, Moses was commanded to take with him 70 to accompany him to the mount, and to be eyewitnesses of God's glory. Meanwhile, I do not deny that there were 2 more than the number 70, But I only point out why God fixed upon this number, that is, to equalize the leaders and heads of the people with the family of Jacob, which was the source of their race and name. In truth, from the fact that, when Moses went up into Mount Sinai to receive the tables from the hand of God, he took with him 70 officers, we infer that the number of those who should excel in honor was already fixed at this, although the charge of governing, which is here spoken of, was not yet committed to them. And it is probable that these same persons who had been appointed leaders were called to this new and unwanted office, as the words themselves imply. It is indeed certain that when the Jews returned from the Babylonish captivity, because they were not permitted to appoint a king, they followed the example here set them in the establishment of their Sanhedrin. Only this honor was paid to the memory of David and their kings, that from their race they chose their 70 rulers in whom the supreme power was vested. And this form of government continued down to Herod, who abolished the whole council, by which he had been condemned, and destroyed the lives of them all. Still, I think that he was not impelled to commit the massacre only out of vengeance, but also lest the dignity of the royal race should be an obstacle to his tyranny. It must, however, be observed that although God promises new grace to the 70 men, he would not have them taken indiscriminately from the people in general, but expressly commands them to be chosen from the order of the elders and heads of the people, being such as were already possessed of authority, and had given proofs of their diligence and virtue. Thus also, nowadays, when he calls both the pastors of the church and magistrates to their office, although he furnishes them with new gifts, still, he would not have them raised to their honorable stations promiscuously, as they may come first, but chooses rather with reference to their spiritual endowments, wherewith he distinguishes and commends those whom he has destined to any exalted office. In short, he commands the most fitting to be chosen. But after they have been elected, he promises that he will add what is wanting. For this reason, he commands that they should station themselves at the door of the tabernacle, that he may there display his grace. Although I think that two other reasons were likewise taken into consideration, that is, that they might know that the office was entrusted to them by God, and might always be mindful of the heavenly tribunal before which they must be accountable, and also that they might be held in additional reverence by the very associations of the place, and that the people might submit to them as the ministers of God. Now, although God does not at present dwell in a visible tabernacle, yet are we reminded by this example that pastors and magistrates are not duly ordained unless they are placed in the presence of God, nor rightly inaugurated in their offices, unless when they consecrate themselves to God himself, and when his majesty, on the other hand, acquires their reverence. Cyprian twists this passage further, but I know not whether on sufficiently firm grounds to prove that bishops are not to be elected except with the consent of the whole people. Verse 18. And say unto the people, sanctify yourselves. This is another part of the answer which is given respecting the matter of consideration, that is, that the people should prepare themselves to satiate their greediness. Although the word kadesh signifies to prepare, yet its literal meaning seems to be most appropriate here. I have therefore retained the word sanctify, which is, however, here used ironically, for Moses does not exhort them to purge themselves from all defilements, and piously and sincerely to receive the grace of God, but he chastises their profane and brutal gluttony. Others translate it simply, as if it were said, "Wet your teeth and make ready your bellies." But in my judgment, there is a reproof implied, because they are polluted by a foul and wicked desire, so as to be incapable of receiving God's paternal favor. For, "Ye shall eat flesh," follows, "because your weeping and complaining has reached the ears of God." By which words he signifies that by their importunate cries they had provoked God's anger, so that they should devour none but deadly food. And soon afterwards it is stated more clearly that by their insolence they had deserved to be destroyed by the bounty of God. "For a whole month," he says, "ye shall gormandize, till it come out of your nostrils, and it be loathsome unto you." Thus he compares them to those guttlers who so overwhelm themselves with gluttony that they are obliged soon afterwards to vomit what they have eaten too greedily, or who abominate the taste of their superfluous luxuries as if they were something filthy. This is what is meant by to come out or to be blown out at the nostrils. Tzara, which we have translated abomination, properly means dispersion. But Moses indicates by it that they shall vomit or spit it out like something unfit to be swallowed. If any should object that it is said in Psalm 78:30, they were not yet estranged from their lust, this is easily solved by understanding that their unrestrained gluttony is there rebuked, as if he called them guttlers, gurgites, whom no abundance can suffice to satisfy. Therefore the prophet says that although they were bursting with excess, they were not satiated, but were so inflamed by their boundless voracity that God's vengeance could alone repress it. But the reason alleged for this is especially to be observed: because they had rejected God who was in the midst of them. By these words, the excuse of error or inadvertency is barred. For if, for the purpose of proving their patience, God had withdrawn his power, the terror which they conceived at his absence might, perhaps, have been excusable. But now, when they knew by sure experience that their means of subsistence were supplied by him, they betray their deliberate wickedness by despising his present beneficence. For that God was in the midst of them is equivalent to his giving manifest tokens both of his infinite power and his paternal favor. These words show us that the more immediately God manifests his grace to us, the more inexcusable we are if we disparage it when it is thus liberally offered to us. What follows might appear not to deserve severe reproof, that is, that they wept before God, but the enormity of the sin is specified directly afterwards, that is, that they were vexed by their departure from Egypt, for this was not merely to repudiate the deliverance which they had so greatly longed for, but to quarrel with God, because he had listened to their cry and had condescended to redeem them from their wretched and lost estate. Verse 21. And Moses said, "The people among whom I am are 600,000. Although Moses' object was right, yet he fell into unbelief and thus stumbled at the very threshold. His pious solicitude indeed impelled him to doubt, because he feared that God's holy name would be exposed to derision and contumely if he should send away empty those to whom he had promised food. But it seemed to him incredible that so mighty a multitude should be sufficiently supplied with flesh. When he calls them 600,000, he either does not calculate their numbers exactly, or indicates that some had died since their departure when he had numbered the people, Exodus 14. Yet it is probable that he referred to the recent census, in which they were found to be 603,550, Numbers 146. But for the sake of brevity, he put the sum in the gross, as he does elsewhere, omitting the 3,550, Exodus 12:37. By speaking of footmen, he means the men, and thus accepts the women and children. Assuredly, such a multitude might astonish him, or at any rate might inspire him with alarm, so that he should mistrust the promise. His doubt, however, was wrong in two respects. First, because he did not simply trust, as if he were not assured that God was true in all his words, and secondly, because he improperly allowed his mind to measure God's inestimable power by his own senses. Let us learn, therefore, that as soon as God has spoken, we should embrace, without discussion, whatever has proceeded out of his mouth. And so likewise let us learn to humble ourselves and our own minds, and at the same time to rise by faith above the world and our natural reason, so that no absurdity which the flesh may suggest to us should prevent us from certainly concluding that whatever God has promised, he will, by his might, perform. For it is a most incorrect calculation to bind down God's doings to ordinary standards, as if his power were not more extensive than our minds can reach. We must, therefore, carefully take notice of the rebuke, whereby God so corrected Moses at once that it ought to prevent and to cure all diseases of distrust in us. For the immensity of God's hand convicts the folly of those who would subject it to their own imaginations and rules. For even although God should not stretch forth his hand, he holds heaven and earth in its hollow, as it is said in Isaiah 40:12. What madness, then, is it to seek to grasp by our own senses, and as it were to imprison that hand, which is greater than 100 worlds? As soon, therefore, as distrust on the score of difficulties begins to take possession of our minds, let this conclusion be remembered, that the promises of God do not exceed the measure of his power to accomplish effectually whatever he has declared. This question, however, "Is the Lord's hand waxed short?" may be explained in two ways. For the old interpreter has rendered it, "Is God's hand weak?" But God seems to adduce the proof whereby he had borne witness to his power, not only in the creation of heaven and earth, but also in so many recent miracles, as if to rebuke the ingratitude of Moses, who had profited so little by these most striking lessons. For Isaiah uses the same word in this sense, where he says, "Behold, the Lord's hand is not shortened," Isaiah 59:1. Moses is unquestionably exalting the blessings received on former occasions, wherein the people had experienced the saving power of God. I have retained the future tense of the verb, since it does not injure the sense. What is said amounts to this: will God's hand be weaker than usual, so as not to put forth its power already known? Verse 24. And Moses went out and told the people the words. We here see how greatly Moses profited by his brief rebuke, for he now actively sets about what he was commanded. Doubt had given him a check, so that he stopped in the middle of his course, whereas he now testifies by the promptitude of his obedience that his distrust is overcome. For just as unbelief discourages men so that they sink down into inactivity, so faith inspires both body and mind with rigor for the effectual discharge of their duties. Although the narrative does not expressly state that he spoke to them respecting the flesh, it declares in general terms that he omitted nothing. And indeed, it would have been very inappropriate to speak only of the 70 elders when the origin of all the evil had been the craving for flesh. Briefly stating, then, that he had reported the commands of God to the people, he includes both parts of the matter, the second of which he then follows up. And first, he says that the elders were called to the tabernacle, that they might there be appointed rulers and officers. When he states that they were set round about, I do not interpret the word so precisely as to suppose that 18 were ranged on each side, and of the rest, half were placed before the court and half behind the tabernacle, but that they were so arranged as to surround some part of the tabernacle. Now, this was evident to their being set before God, so that they might hereafter exercise their office with more authority, as being sent by him, and at the same time that they might devote themselves to God, and dedicate themselves to his service. And also, that being invested with the necessary endowments, they might bear the tokens of their calling. For this reason, it is soon afterwards added that enough of the spirit of Moses was given them for the discharge of their official duties. For, although Moses, by God's command, had chosen men of approved virtue and experience, yet he would have them prepared anew in order that their call might be effectual. When they are said to have prophesied, this was a visible sign of the gift of the Spirit, which, nevertheless, had reference to a different object. For they were not appointed to be prophets, though God would testify by this outward mark that they were new men, in order that the people might receive them with greater reverence. In my opinion, however, prophecy here is equivalent to a special faculty of discoursing magnificently of secret things or mysteries. We know that poets were called prophets by profane writers because poetry itself savors of inspiration, enthusiasmon, in the same way that extraordinary ability, in which the afflatus of the spirit shone forth, obtained the name of prophecy. Thus, the gift of prophecy in Saul was a kind of mark of royalty, so that he might not ascend the throne without credentials. 1 Samuel 10:10. Thus, then, the spirit of prophecy was only accorded to these persons for a short time, since it was sufficient that they should be once marked out by God. For, so I understand what Moses says afterwards, and they added not. It is too forced an interpretation to refer it, as some do, to the past. I confess indeed that they were not previously prophets, but I have no doubt but that Moses here indicates that the gift was a temporary one, as we are also told in the case of Saul. For, as soon as this token of God's grace had manifested itself in him, he ceased to prophesy. The meaning, therefore, is that their call was thus substantiated for a short period, so that this unusual circumstance should awaken the more admiration. Verse 26. But there remained two of the men in the camp. It is not certain why they had not appeared amongst the others. I do not at all doubt but that they were called for by Moses, nor would they have been endued with the same grace of the Spirit as the others, if, through idleness or contempt, they had not come at the time appointed. We may therefore probably infer that they did not actually receive the invitation because they could not be found, and hence it arose that God excused their ignorance. Still, however, it must be observed that they were kept back by the secret counsel of God, that his grace might be made known by this illustrious proof amongst the common people in general, when they were not all eyewitnesses of it. For the greater portion of them had not assembled at the tabernacle. in order, therefore, that its fame might spread more widely and might reach even to the most lowly, God chose that this new and extraordinary gift of his Spirit should be conspicuous in the midst of the camp, lest any of the dullest and grossest among them should pretend to be ignorant of it. In fact, it is plain that they were all aroused by the miracle, for the young man who is spoken of would not have run to bear the incredible news to Moses unless struck by the novelty of the case. Verse 28. And Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of Moses. It is obvious that this foolish and preposterous jealousy arose from a good source. Joshua saw that Moses was so preeminent above all others as to be justly deemed, after God, the head of the people. He feared, therefore, lest, if any portion of his superiority should be withdrawn, the grace of God would be dispelled and lost. We know, too, that almost every change is injurious and apt to give a shock to public affairs. In asserting, then, the rights of Moses, he desired, as far as he could, to consult the welfare of all. But the excess of his zeal had some alloy in it, in consequence of the immoderate affection and love which he bore to Moses. Just as it often happens to ourselves that although our desires have a right object, they still go astray into erroneous feelings. So then, let us learn to revere the most illustrious servants of Christ as that God alone should be supreme, and that he, who is far above all, should still maintain his preeminence. And this will be the case if we hold fast to the principle that although there are diversities of gifts, yet there is but one Spirit from whom they flow. And although there are differences of administrations, yet but one Lord who must be served, 1 Corinthians 12:4 and 5, which Paul also confirms elsewhere, where he teaches us that the gifts are so distributed as that no individual should have all, but each according to the measure of the gift of Christ, Ephesians 4:7. Verse 29. And Moses said unto him, Enviest thou for my sake? This may be understood in two different ways. Some take it as if Moses had said, It is no business of yours if I have suffered any loss, and if anything is taken from me, it would be mine and not yours to grieve and grudge. But I think Moses spoke more simply, as if he had said, Behold how differently I feel from you. For I, whose cause you suppose yourselves to be promoting, should desire that all were endowed with the spirit of prophecy. So was that foolish jealousy admirably rebuked, which would put a restraint upon God's blessing, so greatly to be desired by every pious mind. At the same time, we fully perceive the gentleness and humility of Moses, whom no ambition nor consideration of his personal dignity prevents from willingly admitting the very lowliest into companionship with himself. If any should object that it is God's pleasure, in order to enhance the excellency of the gift, that there should be but few prophets in the church, and consequently that Moses inconsiderately sought for that, which is in repugnance to God's counsel in this matter, the reply is easy. That, although saints acquiesce in his ordinary dispensations, and are persuaded that the arrangement which he makes is the best, yet that it is an act of piety in them to desire to communicate with all others what is given to themselves, so as to be anxious rather to be last of all than to begrudge perfection to their brethren. In sum, Moses declares that nothing would be more gratifying to him than that God should diffuse the grace of the spirit of prophecy amongst the whole people, so that all should be partakers of it, from the least to the greatest. Verse 30. And Moses gat him into the camp. Although, after the appointment of the 70, all betook themselves to their own stations and dwelling places, yet there is no doubt but that they were all forewarned of the approaching miracle, so as to be universally attentive to the event which is presently related. When it is said that it was a wind of the Lord which brought the quails, there was no other reason for this than that God might openly manifest that all things under heaven are subject to his dominion and are ready to obey him. He might, indeed, have created the quails at will, just as he rained the manna from heaven. Nor was it natural that by the force of the winds such an abundance of birds should be eased and heaped together in one place. But by using the aid of the wind, he confirmed what is written in Psalm 104, 3 and 4, that he maketh the winds his messengers, and they bear him on their wings. Because in their swiftness they rapidly bear his commandments from the east to the west. Now, although it is true in the abstract that the winds come from him, so that they are only his breath, and that the air cannot be stirred in the slightest degree except at his will, still an extraordinary miracle is here specified, as before in the passage of the Red Sea. The prophet in the psalm goes further. He caused an east wind to blow in the heaven, and by his power he brought in the south wind. Psalm 78:26. In which words he signifies that the whole air was shaken, since the winds suddenly arose from different quarters, which covered the earth in all directions with an immense multitude of the birds. When he says that the earth was filled as it were a day's journey, I do not understand it as if dead birds lay at so great a distance, but that they occupied such a space of ground in thick heaps, and in fact, continuously. And this also we gather from the psalm, where the prophet says that they fell in the midst of their camp, and were carried to their tents round about, Psalm 78:28. What is added as to their being 2 cubits high, I do not interpret as some do, that they did not fly above 2 cubits from the ground, so as to be more easily taken with the hand, but that there was such a mass of them that everyone might carry away as much as he would. For to this also do those magnificent descriptions in the psalm relate, whereby the miracle is extolled. He rained flesh also upon them as dust, and feathered fowls like as the sand of the sea. Psalm 78:27. But how they spread them abroad round about is not very clear to me, unless perhaps they were placed in cages or coops, and daily taken out for food. Verse 33. And while the flesh was yet between their teeth. Moses does not specify any particular day, but only that God did not wait till satiety had produced disgust, but inflicted the punishment in the midst of their greediness. We may, however, conjecture from what precedes that time was given them to gorge themselves. From whence their insatiable voracity may be gathered, which prevailed for so many continuous days and could not be appeased by any quantity of food. God, therefore, allowed them time abundantly sufficient for them to gorge themselves, unless their gluttony was prodigious, and yet punished their intemperance while the meat was yet in their mouths. They were, then, suddenly surprised in the midst of their guttling. And hence it is said in the psalm, Psalm 78:30, they were not yet estranged from their lust. Just as any glutton might choke himself by devouring more than his throat could hold. Nor is that at variance with their repletion of which mention was lately made, for however the belly may swell with the quantity of its contents, the furious lust of eating is never appeased. But in order that their punishment might be more manifest, God inflicted it in the very act, nor could any better opportunity have been chosen. Verse 34. and he called the name of that place Kibroth Hattaava. It was requisite that some memorial of so great a sin should exist, that the sons might not imitate their fathers. Heretofore God had sustained them with a food both agreeable and wholesome. By longing for unlawful nourishment, they were their own poisoners and murderers. Now, such ingratitude was deservedly to be detested by their posterity, and therefore the name was given to the place, not without the inspiration of the Spirit of God. So Paul reminds us that, in this narrative, God's judgment against corrupt and vicious lusts was portrayed, that we might ourselves learn not to lust. 1 Corinthians 10:6. I have already briefly explained how far our appetites are to be restrained and what intemperance, properly speaking, is. This audio recording was read by Michael Ives. I hope you found it enlightening and edifying. Visit westportexperiment.com for more audio resources and where I write about parish missions, the care of souls, and all things Reformed.